The police were supposedly hunting for the Browning automatic, questioning Mackenzie's friends and searching his hangouts. I tried to remember what Earl's goons had been carrying when they'd grabbed me. Fred had had a Colt, but I thought Tony might have had a Browning. I wondered if Bobby Mallory had made that arrest. I decided I needed to get back to Chicago and talk to him. Sunday morning traffic was light, and I made it to Halsted by a little after 10. Across from my apartment was a car with a police antenna on it. Sergeant McGonagall was sitting there alone with a newspaper. "Good morning, Sergeant," I said. "Beautiful day, isn't it?"
"Good morning, Miss Warshawski," he said. "Mind if I come up with you and ask you a few questions? We got a couple of inquiries in, and Bobby thought I'd better see if you're all right. That's quite a shine you've picked up."
"Yes, it is," I agreed. "How long have you been here?"
"I stopped by last night, but you weren't home. And when I stopped by this morning, I just thought I'd wait until noon to see if you showed up."
We got to the top of the stairs, and McGonagall stopped.
"You usually leave your door open?"
The door was open, hanging drunkenly. Someone had shot out the locks to get in. McGonagall pulled out his gun and rolled into the room. My apartment was a mess. The sofa cushions had been cut open, pictures thrown on the floor, books dropped so that they lay with crumpling pages. My clothes were scattered around the bedroom. Worst of all, in the dining room, the red Venetian glasses which my mother had brought safely all the way from Italy were lying crazily on the table. Two had fallen off. One had shattered on the floor. My hands were shaking too much to pick up the pieces.
"Don't touch anything, Miss Warshawski,"
McGonagall said.
"I'm going to call Lieutenant Mallory and get some fingerprint experts over here."
I nodded. "The phone is next to what used to be the couch," I said. "And I'll bet you dinner at the Savoy that whoever came through here wore gloves and you won't find a damn thing." I looked at him. "I'd like to know what you were doing when the tornado came through. Sitting reading your newspaper? Who came in and out of the building while you were here?" He flushed. Mallory was going to ask him the same question.
"I don't think this was done while I was here, but I'll ask your neighbors if they heard any noise."
He went to check downstairs. I went to the bedroom and packed a suitcase of clothes. I put the box from Riley's gun shop in, too, and then called Lottie. "Lottie," I said, "my apartment has been ravaged. Can I come and stay a few nights?"
"Naturally, Vic."
I took the suitcase down to the car, and as I put it in the trunk, Mallory came squealing up to the curb with a couple of squad cars hot behind him. They double-parked, lights flashing.
"What the hell is going on here, Vicky?"
Bobby asked. "Someone tore my place up. They smashed one of Gabriella's glasses." Mallory had been charging up the stairs, but that stopped him. He'd drunk too many New Year's toasts out of those glasses.
Vicky, I'm sorry. Why don't we go sit in my car? Anything valuable that might be missing?"
I shrugged. Who knows what's valuable to a ransacker? A couple of pieces of jewelry that were my mother's, a little silver flatware. I don't know. I just looked and looked away.
"Okay,"
Bobby said. He waved a hand and four uniformed men started up the stairs.
"And send McGonagall down to me,"
he called after them. We went to Bobby's car and sat in the front seat.
"What happened to your face?"
"I ran into a door."
"Don't clown, Vicky. You know why I sent McGonagall over to talk to you?"
"Why?"
"Because John Thayer told me last night that you'd been beaten up and you didn't believe that Mackenzie had committed the crime."
"John Thayer?" I echoed, incredulous. "He threw me out of his house because I wouldn't accept his word that Mackenzie was the murderer." Bobby smiled sourly.
"He believes it was Mackenzie, but he wants to be sure. Now tell me about your face."
"There's nothing to tell."
"Vicky, after I talked to Thayer, I had McGonagall see if anyone had turned in anything on a battered woman. And we found a cabbie had mentioned picking up a woman at Astor and dropping her at your address. The guy was worried because you looked in pretty bad shape. Then McGonagall remembered how Earl Smyson owns a condo on Astor. So now we want to know why Earl wanted to beat you up. The only reason I can think of is that he's tied to the Thayer boy. Maybe had him shot when someone else fingered him.
Then, I said, like me, you don't think Mackenzie is the killer either. Mallory was silent.
You make the arrest?
No, Mallory said stiffly. Lieutenant Carlson did.
Carlson? Who's he work for?
Captain Vespucci,
Mallory said shortly. I raised my eyebrows. Vespucci had been implicated in a number of scandals, most of them having to do with police bought off by the mob. But there'd never been enough evidence to justify throwing him off the force. He had the kind of connections that made you keep quiet.
Carlson and Vespucci pretty close? I asked.
Yes, Bobby said abruptly.
I thought for a minute. Did someone, like Earl, bring pressure on Vespucci to make an arrest for the Thayer killing? Is Donald Mackenzie another poor slob caught in a trap because he was in the wrong part of town? Has he made a confession?
No, but he can't account for his time on Monday, and as far as the department is concerned, the case is closed.
And?
And nothing. My captain says it's a defensible arrest.
Your captain owe anything to Vespucci? I asked.
Mallory made a violent motion. Don't talk like that to me, Vicky. Let's talk about your apartment. Someone was looking for something. What?
I shook my head. Beats me. None of my clients has given me the secret to the neutron bomb or even a new brand of toothpaste. And any time I do have important evidence, I leave it in a safe in my office. My voice trailed off. Why hadn't I thought of that sooner? The people who had roughed up my apartment were probably in my office now.
Give me the address of your office,
Bobby said. Then he ordered a patrol car to check. Sergeant McGonagall came up to the car.
Who came in and out of the building while you were watching it?
Bobby asked him.
Nobody, sir, but one of the residents, sir, Mrs. Alvarez, says she heard a lot of noise about 3 this morning, but she didn't pay much attention to it. Says Miss Warshawski often has strange guests and wouldn't thank her for interfering.
Thanks, Mrs. Alvarez, I thought. The city needs more neighbors like you.
By the way, Bobby said, we got a call last night from Riley's gun shop. The guy said a V.I. Warshawski had bought a small handgun, and he was worried. She looked rather wild. If you're planning on using that gun, Vicky, get down to City Hall first thing tomorrow morning and register it. Now tell Sergeant McGonagall where you're going to be until your place is fixed up again.
When I got to Lottie's, it was afternoon. I had stopped on the way to call my answering service. A Mr. McGraw and a Mr. Devereux had both phoned. Lottie greeted me with a worried headshake.
Not content with beating you, they beat your apartment.
I'd like to ask the answering service to switch my home calls here, I said to her. Lottie shrugged.
In that case, I won't switch off the phone by the guest bed. But I warn you, it rings at all hours. Women having babies, boys being shot. They don't keep 9-to-5 schedules. Now I must leave you. My advice is, have a drink, relax.
I sat down and called McGraw. Good afternoon, Mr. McGraw. I hear you've been trying to get in touch with me.
Yes, about my daughter. I don't want you to go any further now the police have arrested this drug addict.
What? I said incredulously. You don't want me to find Anita? Since you and I last talked, McGraw, I have been beaten and my apartment and probably my office decimated by Earl Smyson in an effort to get me off the case.
What Earl does has no bearing on anything I do,
McGraw answered.
Send me a bill for your expenses. Throw in your apartment if you want to, but quit.
Very well, I said in cold anger. I'll send you a bill. But you're wrong about one thing, McGraw, and you can tell Earl from me. You can fire me, but you can't get rid of me. At least McGraw had agreed to knowing Earl, or at least to knowing who he was. I decided the time for action had arrived. First, I'd check on my office. Then I was going to search Peter Thayer's apartment. I changed out of the green slacks into jeans and fastened the shoulder holster over a man-tailored shirt. I practiced drawing the gun until it came out quickly and naturally. Then I slipped on a jacket and left. It being Sunday, I was able to park outside my office.
The office door was closed, but its upper half had been shattered. Inside, the damage wasn't as severe as to my apartment, but I decided I'd better call a repair service for the door, or the place would be ransacked by thieves. Then I continued on my way to the south side. I parked behind the Thayer apartment and entered the building. I had no trouble finding a key that opened the apartment door. The same people that had been to my place had done a similar job here. Of course. They were looking for something and had been here first. The only things that were still intact were appliances and floors. I made a methodical search of all the rooms without success. It was 6:30 when I returned to the kitchen. It was possible that what was missing hadn't been hidden deliberately, but had been dropped. A piece of paper, for instance, might float unnoticed under the stove. I lay on my stomach and shone a flashlight under it. I couldn't see anything, but using the jack from my trunk as a lever, I slowly pried the stove off the floor and looked underneath. There it was, a piece of paper stuck by grease to the bottom of the stove. I peeled it off and took it over to the window to examine. It was a carbon copy with the Ajax logo on it. In the center it read, "Draft only, not negotiable." And it was made out to Joseph Gilchowski of South Ingleside, Illinois. Joseph Gilchowski could take this to a bank, and Ajax would pay the sum of $250 to the bank as a workers' compensation indemnity payment. The transaction sounded perfectly straightforward. What was so important about it?